Okay, so I'll be talking about the geometry of 2D spin glasses. First, I'm going to start by giving you a basic picture of 2D spin glasses. I'm going to remind you of the Hamiltonian, what the excitations are like, and what the ground state is like. I'm going to be working on the ground state. I'm going to tell you why when we get there. But we're going to look at, so this is going to be a spin model, and we're going to be interested in the geometry of domain walls in this model. And please slow me down if I go too fast through that. I assume a number of you are familiar with spin glasses, so please ask questions. Actually, I know from being here for the past week and a half that people here will ask questions, so I'm trusting you to do so. The rest of it will be largely experimental talk in some sense. I'm going to talk about numerical work on spin glass domain walls and some results we have. Now, I want to make it very clear that our work was inspired by the work that was put on CondMed in January by Amoruso, Hastings, Hartmann, and Moore, where they looked at spin glass domain walls using their methods. And it's been very nice this week to have a chance to talk with Matt Hastings and catch up and find out what parts they've done that are very similar to what we've done. I mean, they've did some logical things that we had also done. And he will be talking at the end today, or maybe he will also interrupt me some to let me know what they've done in comparison with what we've done, and we're trying to coordinate some on that. So I'm going to present here towards the end especially some evidence that 2D spin glass domain walls are described by SLE. When Pierre and Dani and I started this project, actually when we looked at this paper, we thought that, well, how could this be? And honestly, that's the way I thought, and so let's go check it out ourselves in more detail. And in the end, we ended up supporting a lot of what they propose. So one of the things I'm going to focus on very much is that we have a number of tests for this, and that we compare our tests, we use the same analysis path for other things where we know the answer. Because we don't want to be tricked into making conclusions based on similarities that are there or not there compared with other models. Okay. So here's our Hamiltonian. It's Ising spins plus minus one spins interacting with each other on a lattice with a JIJ, where the JIJ are Gaussian variables with zero mean and unit variance. Ferromagnet, of course, these would be all positive and the spins would line up. The JIJs being positive and negative is what gives the system frustration and makes the ground state at zero temperature non-trivial. So we're looking at the T equals zero phase. Now at higher dimensions, that's justified because you can show the temperature is irrelevant, or you can argue the temperature is irrelevant under certain conditions, and therefore you can look at the ground state to understand the finite temperature case. In the two-dimensional spin glass, it turns out that the phase I'm going to be describing for you and its excitations exist only at zero temperature. So this is a zero temperature phase for the spin glass. And we're going to be looking at the ground state. So instead of averaging over thermal disorder, as we would in many of the other things we've heard about in statistical mechanics, we're going to be averaging over the JIJs, over the realization. That's going to be our measure. And we're going to select the ground states and study those within that measure. So here's the ground state. 220 by 150. White is up, black is down. We'll call this state alpha. The spin flip state would be beta. I'm going to use periodic boundary conditions in the horizontal direction and open in the vertical. I generated this ground state using an image processing program to generate white noise. Because the ground states in the spin glass, if you look at the spins alone, are given by white noise. Because there's a gauge invariance where you can flip the JIJs locally and change with the same measure. You can maintain, there's no correlations in the spins in the ground state. Okay? So the thing that we're going to be concerned about then are these domain walls, because if you look at the ground state in a spin glass for a particular realization of JIJ, it looks random, it is random, but if you change boundary conditions, you create excitations that we're going to look at. And so there will be a reverse pattern, beta, and we're going to be looking at boundaries between, imagine this flipped relative to this, with some domain walls separating them.
What motivates the choice of boundary conditions?
Sorry? Well, there's a couple motivations. One is we're going to map this onto a cylinder and try to understand stuff like conformal field theory. That might be the smooth answer. The other answer is it's very hard to find the ground state with fully periodic boundary conditions. And also, it is natural for doing twisted boundary conditions to be working on a cylinder on a strip geometry like this that we wrap around. Okay, so given some set of spins, SI, you can define some variables, let's call them just the satisfaction variables, that are going to be given by JIJ times the SI, SJ that live on the ends of the bond. And So if you had some Jij that was 3 and you had 1 and 1, you had upspin and upspin, then F would be 3. If you had up, down, and a minus 5, F would be 5. The ground state maximizes the sums of the Fi's. And what's, if you look at, I'm going to work on triangular lattice, so let me draw this here. Of course, just remind you, in spin glasses, the important thing comes from frustration, which is if you look at the Jij's, the product of the Jij's around a loop, it's less than 0, that's frustrated. And of course, in that case, the product of the Fij's would be less than 0 because the spins would cancel around the loop. Now, and the Fij's are going to be defined on dual bonds like this. So the Fij's live here on the dual lattice, the Jij's live on the primal lattice, on the original lattice. And maybe I'll draw a picture, I'll show you a picture in a moment. I'm told that you can't see over there very well, so let me try this side. If you look on a lattice like this, and you take some spin assignment, and you flip the spins in some block, all the Fij's within that block will be unchanged because they'll be, the product will be unity of the product of the spin changes. But across the block, there will be a change in the Fij's here. And so what that leads to is a relative change like this in the Fij's. So the Fij's will be changed along some path like this. So if I flip a block of spins, these 6 spins here, I will create a path around them, something like this, where the Fij's will change sign if I flip a block of spins. Okay, so how are we going to study this problem numerically? We're going to use, we're going to map this to a matching problem. It turns out from 1982, there's a very nice mapping to a matching problem. We'll solve that directly. And to maximize the total satisfaction and to get the exact ground state. And the ground state has no negative loops in the Fij's. Because if you flip a block of spins, you change the signs of the Jij's around a loop. And so if the sum of the Fij's around a loop were negative, that couldn't be the ground state. Because if you could flip the spins with inside that block and lower the energy, it turns out. So that's a very important property of the ground state, is there are no negative loops in these frustration variables or these satisfaction variables. In practice, this algorithm takes n squared, or if you have square samples, about L to the fourth time to solve for a ground state. Okay, so now what we're going to do here is let me draw you a picture of a lattice. Lost a couple bonds there. So again, we have a cylinder. And if I change the boundary conditions on the cylinder, I change it from periodic to anti-periodic around the cylinder. That would correspond to changing the Jij's to change their sign along a path from the top to the bottom and somewhere there. And what this does is when you compare the ground states with periodic and anti-periodic boundary conditions, you create a relative domain wall where you go from an alpha phase to a beta phase, but it's wrapped around because of the negative periodic boundary conditions. It's just like a ferromagnet. You can create a boundary wall by a change, by putting on anti-periodic boundary conditions and looking at where it goes from plus to minus at some point. And this is what we'll do. So we'll solve for the ground state with periodic and anti-periodic boundary conditions. And the domain wall energy will be the sum, will be find the minimum path along these Fij's from top to bottom and minimize that. And that is the domain wall in this case. So you can look at solving the domain wall problem as finding the ground state in the spin glass, determining the Fij's on the dual lattice, and then finding the shortest path from the top to the bottom. And that gives you a domain wall. Okay? Questions about domain walls or anything? Clear enough? Yeah. Echo, yes.
Essentially, the domain wall is free to choose the entry point wherever wants to, right? Where it's optimal.
I'm going to do both cases.
But you can fix it also.
I can fix it or I can let it be free.
How do you fix it?
I fix it in the algorithm I use. I change the bound. It gets a little technical, but I change. There's an external plaquette, if you like, here. And I change the I can change the parity of the products of the FIJs along the top and bottom in the both. I can control them.
So it's not sufficient just to fix this pins along the upper and lower line?
You might be able to do that, but the thing is all these algorithms actually work with the frustrations. They don't work with the spins directly. So that's kind of a technical point how I do that, and I didn't want to spend too much time with the algorithm. I can certainly explain it to you. Yes?
You probably have said it already twice, but he is the most... Yes. How do you impose boundary conditions to generate the curve?
How do I impose boundary conditions? Okay, what I do is in the algorithm... Let me see, how do I do this? This is a little...
To create the curve, you need to impose some boundary conditions.
Right. Okay, so if you think of a ferromagnet, you can impose the boundary conditions by changing the JIJs along some column. And effectively, I can do that here also. So I change it. If I had a ferromagnet, all of them were positively interacting with each other, the ground state would be all the same direction. I can impose a domain wall by changing the JIJs along one column.
Sorry, what do you mean changing? Because
they do flip. Reverse the sign, and fix them. So I can make all the JIJs positive, or I can make all the JIJs positive except negative in one column.
Who's the boundary?
No, from top to bottom. From this direction. In this direction. So if I reverse the sign of the bonds in this direction, that's changing the whether I'm periodic or anti-periodic in this direction. Now in the spin glass, because the average JIJs are zero, the periodic and the anti-periodic ground state energy have the same expectation for their energy. So I may go to anti-periodic and it may lower the energy. I may go to periodic, so it doesn't. I can't tell ahead of time which one is going to have lower energy, whether it's going to be periodic.
Thinking about the cylinder.
Yes.
Take the base of the cylinder.
Yes.
The cable goes along the cylinder.
Yes, it goes along the cylinder.
The lower base of the cylinder.
Yes.
Right? This is the, I suppose, to change the boundary condition to generate the curve, huh?
I could do that if I'm thinking. I'm not doing that here. I actually am changing things at the boundary. One way to think of it is changing the way people usually think of it is changing the JIJs along a column. But I actually am in the algorithm doing something at the boundary. But I don't want to get into the details of the algorithm. I don't want to dodge the question. But I just think it would take a while to explain exactly how I do it. But think of it.
My concern is misunderstanding.
Yes.
Due to the fact that here, J's fluctuate.
J's are fixed. I pick a sample and I compute the ground state, and then I compute the ground state with the same JIJs, except I flip the JIJs in sign along one column. And then I compare those two. And that's my periodic versus anti-periodic boundary conditions.
In one realization, the ombitetic might be lower than entries, and the domain will sit in the periodic case. And in another realization, it might be flipped, isn't it?
The only way we can... You compare the ground states. You compare the ground states in the two cases. They both look random, but when you compare them, you'll see that they differ along a path that's the domain wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that it'll change sign once you cross that domain wall.
Mm-hmm.
So think of that white noise I had. Flip the sign of it. And the domain wall between, a boundary between them. You can't see the domain wall with your eye. You have to compare with the ground state.
It's one sector is lower than the other one.
In the flip-flop, right. Okay. Okay, so now here's the domain wall in the two. Here's a sample one for a 600 squared sample. And again, you compare the satisfactions in the ground state, okay, and it looks fairly fractal. People have known this fractal for quite some time, as I'll mention in a minute. And numerically, I can do up to 10 to the fourth samples, half a million spins, pretty regularly. And I'm going to study two pairs of boundary conditions. One is going to be where the domain wall is free to pick the best way on the top and the bottom, or the other one is going to be free localized, where it's free at the top, but I force the domain wall to start at a particular location. Yes?
One more question. How do you visualize where the domain wall is? How do you
plan? So in the algorithm, I calculate the ground state frustrations. I compute the FIJs. And then I
compute... Two sets of FIJs.
Right. I have two sets of FIJs, and I overlap them. And where they differ, that's exactly the domain wall. It forms a simply connected path. There can't be loops because that would mean there was... Yeah, okay. I'm assuming people know more about spin glasses than...
So in a magnet, spins fluctuate, but here in the glass, both spins and bounds.
Well, let me try to say it carefully one time. I select the JIJ, I compute the ground state. There's no fluctuations at zero temperature. I choose another sample, I calculate the ground state with periodic and antiperiodic boundary conditions. Once I pick a sample, this domain wall is given. I pick it. I generate a new sample, I get a new domain wall.
Here's my question.
There's no fluctuation. I'm doing the zero temperature.
But later we'll study statistics of this domain.
Yes, I will. Averaged over the measure given by the JIJ.
So they do fluctuate.
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by fluctuate. Yes, they're not the same in all samples. They differ from sample to sample.
Well, eventually you will be averaging.
Yes, I will be, absolutely.
Given
the JIJ is
sorry, am I missing something? Yeah, answer.
So you
should have
periodic molecule. Given the GIG, you have one constant. Then you would multiply the periodic molecule condition. Given the same set of GIG, you have another constant. If you can compare the two, and when you compare the two, it gives you the domain wall.
But then
every GIG, you have one domain wall.
Yes, but then averaging will be made differently for one boundary condition.
No, because the periodic cut is the domain wall. Given the GIG, you have one pass.
No, I'm asking the colleague. When you average it over the J's,
yes.
This averaging mix this boundary condition together.
I measure the statistics for a particular domain wall, like how much it wanders, its fractal, its average length, and stuff like that. And then I'm going to compute the average over the JIJ, say, of the length of the domain wall. So let me give you an example of application. If I don't quite answer your question, come back to me very quickly. So I have a domain wall. So this is done by Braymore, McMillan, and Fisher and Hughes in the droplet model. And they had Braymore, and then independently McMillan had this domain wall renormalization group type of picture, where you look at the distribution of domain wall energies. So you generate a domain wall energy, for each JIJ, and then you look at the distribution, and the distribution of the domain wall energy has, it's centered at zero by symmetry, and has some width, and that width goes as L to the theta, where L is the height of my cylinder. Okay? So the domain wall energy scales as L to the theta, where theta is some negative exponent. And the fact that it's negative tells you that domain walls, as you go to in the thermodynamic limit, approach zero energy, which is why the 2D spin glass is unstable to finite temperature. Because excitations become very cheap as you go to large scales, as opposed to the 3D spin glass. Now then here, the length of the domain wall is given by L to the DF. On average, if you look at the average, I should put some overline in here, actually, to indicate average over the JIJs. If I look at the average domain wall energy or the average length scales as some fractal dimension, about 1.28, where the numbers in parentheses indicate the numerical error, kind of generally accepted values. Okay, I want to just mention two curves that we're going to compare with. One is the loop erased random walk, where you start at, say, some point, and you start a random walk. And whenever the random walk, we'll do this on the lattice because I can talk about that more easily. When the random walk returns to where it intersects itself, it creates a loop. You remove the loop, and you continue the random walk. That's the loop erased random walk. It's one of these favorite objects to study in SLE. If you come back, you touch yourself, you erase, and you start, you keep on continuing your random walk. Okay, the loop erased random walk is well known to have a fractal dimension of 5/4. The other object we look at is the minimal spanning tree. I have less data to show you here because I just don't have the time to show you all the data we have. There, the fractal dimension is about 1.217. Now notice I've chosen these also in particular because they're close to the fractal dimension of the domain wall in the spin glass, which is about 1.28. I want to note something here, which is if you do the numerics, the fractal dimension that you obtain, that is the fractal dimension defined as the path length as a function of your system size for the loop erased random walk, is independent of the boundary conditions. Okay, now it turns out that the loop erased random walk, whether it's SLE or not, the stochastic Lovner evolution or Schramm Lovner evolution, applies. Whether SLE applies to a loop erased random walk depends very much on the boundary conditions. So this is one important point here, is that the fractal dimension may be independent of boundary conditions, but the fact of whether the curve is described by SLE does depend very much on the boundary conditions. So it's telling you the fractal dimension doesn't tell you enough about the object.
What is the value, Frank, for this?
Sorry?
What's the value
for for the spin glass, it's about 1.28. With an error of 1. That's well established, fairly large sizes.
Boundary conditions. I would use periodic boundary conditions.
Yeah.
How large is it?
700 squared, say. 500 by 1,000. Okay. It's also much harder to find the ground state numerically in periodic boundary conditions, it turns out. Okay.
The minimal spanning tree to that result is yours, Wilson?
Oh, that, this predates Wilson, this type of study of the fractal dimension. The fact that it's not conformally invariant, that's not described by SLE, is, as far as I know, Wilson's discovery. Right, in this paper. So it looks fractal, but again, it's not described by SLE. So loop race random walk, whether it's SLE or not, depends on boundary conditions. Minimal spanning tree is just not even conformally invariant, it turns out, but it has a fractal dimension.
Do you do great finite scale collection analysis?
I could show you the curves. They're really converged to these particular values of the fractal dimension. I mean, I'm very careful about that.
That is not
5 over 4. One time some years ago I thought it might be 5 over 4, but it's not 5 over 4. I'm very convinced of that. I'll show you more data that will really show it's not 5 over 4 today. Okay, so, but one of the things I want to mention here is we want to watch out for imposters. The reason we're doing these comparisons, we're comparing to all kinds of different models. We want to see what models pass certain statistical tests and which don't. So let's remember a very famous imposter, which is Odysseus. Odysseus, was in Polyphemus's cave some thousands of years ago, and to get away, they stabbed him in the eye with a hot stick, and then he got out of the cave by clinging to a sheep and going outside the cave. And Polyphemus knew that Odysseus might try to escape that way, so he's feeling the sheep as they came out, and he felt only the top of the sheep and didn't check underneath. So if you feel the top of the sheep, I think that's like checking the fractal dimension. Okay, so you might be tricked into thinking that something is described by certain types of stochastic geometries, but you have to be more careful. I think you should also check underneath the sheep to see whether it's really a sheep or not. Now, why would you want to know whether it's a sheep or not? Now, so something like SLE is very simple to describe, it's Brownian motion and conformal maps. I mean, it's a very simple object. And some of these other things might be more complicated. And so we want to decide which is which. So is it tricky, like Odysseus is tricky, and it's fooling us into thinking it's a sheep, or is it really a sheep? That's the thing we want to look at for the spin glass. Okay, now I'll take just two slides here to make an aside about boundary conditions and the infinite volume limit, because it has some relevance to what I'm going to discuss here. One of the things that's been a matter of controversy over the years is the ground state, or actually just low temperature state, whether there's a unique thermodynamic limit, is there a unique thermodynamic state in a technical sense as you go to large system sizes. And you have this replica symmetry breaking, which appears to describe mean field theories and so on, and you have low temperature, low dimension systems, which the droplet model has been used heavily to describe what's going on. And they have a very different picture of the thermodynamic limit. And it's very closely related to the effect of boundary conditions. And since boundary conditions are going to play a role in what we're talking about here, let me briefly mention this. Yes. So I'll tell you about some work I did some time ago where I looked at this two-dimensional spin glass, and this is following suggestions by Newman and Stein and so on. The way they looked at it mathematically is you solve for the ground state in a sample with disorder in a box of some size L. And then you look at it, then you add more disorder around it and look at a larger system of size L prime. And you solve again for the ground state. And then you compare it in this way that I've been talking about and look for relative domain walls. And this is the picture of a sample comparison that you get when you do that. So you generate, so originally you had some ground state, and when you expanded the system, you changed all alpha to alpha, beta, beta. So you've put in domain walls by growing the system. Now, it turns out that if you think that when you do this, you typically induce one domain wall that has the size of the system, then you can easily argue that as the as this L grows larger, and as this L prime grows larger, the chance of change of this domain wall intersecting this interior window of size W goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. It's a very physical type of idea. You take a sample, you look at the inside, you start adding stuff on the outside, and you see whether the interior changes. And it tells you something about the sensitivity to the boundary in the system. And you can argue, again, based upon the fractal dimension of the domain wall, how that should decrease, and the numerics actually line up quite well with that prediction. And you find that the probability that the domain wall will intersect a volume of finite size goes to zero as the system goes to infinity, no matter how large your initial window is. So that implies that confirmed is numerically confirmed, it hasn't been proved mathematically, that for several disordered models, including the two-dimensional Ising spin glasses, you go to larger systems, you get convergence to a unique thermodynamic state. But what's interesting here also is you get a unique thermodynamic state even though theta is negative, where theta is the energy exponent. And that has to do with the fact that these domain walls are fractal. And that means that you can't fit too many of them into one place because they're not straight lines. And so they exclude each other, and so so you typically only do have one or two or three large domain walls as you grow the system. Okay. This blue I'm not going to take time to mention. One thing I do want to mention here that's very important for what I'm going to say in the subsequent part is there erasers? So let's look at two boundary conditions. One boundary condition on the cylinder is I'm going to have it open at both ends, and it can go anywhere it likes. Both ends are free to move to optimize this path from top to bottom. We'll call that free. The other choice will be localized free, where I pick the start of the domain wall. And I can do that in the algorithm, as I've mentioned, though I haven't really told you how I do that. And I let the other end be free. So I tie down one end. Now that's awkward and it's expensive. Expensive not in the computational sense, it's expensive in the energetic sense. Because by fixing the domain wall to go through some small region here of some microscopic size of order one, I pay an energy cost that is of order one. Okay, so this is delta E, I pay some energy cost of order one. But the energy of a domain wall should scale as L to the theta, with theta is less than zero. This goes to zero as L becomes large. So fixing the domain wall boundary in the two-dimensional spin glass is an unnatural thing to do. It's an unnatural thing to do because it messes with the energy scales in the problem. And it introduces a hierarchy of energies at different scales. And so it breaks the kind of scale invariance that you would have in the original system. I mean, fixing it to some region that was size of a fraction of L would be okay, but if you actually fix it microscopically, you change the system.
But letting it be totally free is also unnatural.
Sorry?
Letting it be totally free at the boundary is also unnatural.
Freedom is unnatural. Let me think.
you introduce an edge field, okay? It's all
important. Yeah, I know where you're coming from when you say that. We'll come back. This will come up again and again, okay, during the remaining so many minutes. So here's one check we did for conformal invariance. If this domain wall is described by SLE, where, again, if some of us don't know everything about SLE, one of the things I remember, of course, is this beautiful formula that the fractal dimension is 1 plus kappa over 8, where kappa is this the diffusion constant for the Brownian motion that generates the SLE. You can predict the winding number on a cylinder. And so we have done that. We take long cylinders. Say in this case, this is hard to see, this is W equals 32. So I have 32 lattice steps around the circumference. and I go up to systems of 800 or even higher now length, and I look at this domain wall as it winds around the cylinder, and I measure the separation between the endpoints. Of course, if it winds around more than once, this angle becomes greater than 2 pi. I'm measuring really the total angle of the winding angle around the cylinder with free boundary conditions. And if you look at the fluctuations in the endpoint then, okay, so this is the sample-to-sample fluctuations in the endpoint displacement. It looks Gaussian. And if you look at if you just look at the delta x, it's the Gaussian distribution. You look at the expectation value of delta x squared as a function of length. You fit it, and you can't read that there, I'm sorry. But there, that fit gives you an effective kappa, which is 2.32 with an uncertainty of 2. Okay, so if you take 1.28, subtract 1, multiply it by 8, you get 2.32. So this is quite consistent with an SLE picture for this domain wall.
So how many chips is this really Gaussian?
I look at the distribution. So I do many samples, several tens of thousands of samples. I plot the probability distribution function for delta x. And I could show you the plots sometime. I do on log plots, very parabolic. Yeah.
So you don't check separately this force cumulant vanish.
Well, I've done that too. Yes, I have actually. Yes. Yeah, higher cumulants vanish. For anything that I claim that Gaussian is this talk, I've claimed the third and fourth cumulants. Actually, I mean, yeah, the higher. So, okay. One of the beautiful predictions from SLE, okay, again, if you don't know about SLE, it predicts the statistical properties of curves, if you assume some properties about these curves. If you look at the probability of the domain wall passing to a right of a particular point, so you create some domain wall, and if you believe in SLE, Schramm has shown that if you can compute the probability distribution given kappa, this parameter kappa, of the domain wall passing to the right of a particular point. So here's the geometry we use in the simulations. We put circles at this radius, we put on a whole bunch of points, and we just measure the probability to pass to the left or right of a particular point. This is a hypergeometric function. Phi is the angle, this is a gamma function. It's all, put it into Maple, it'll plot it for you. Okay, you can actually get analytic forms for some kappa, of course. So, okay, this takes just a little bit of explaining here. So, what you do then is I plot the probability distribution function as a function of this angle phi between 0 and pi, the cumulative probability distribution of passing to the right of a particular point, and you get some curve that looks like this. Okay? The error bars are very small on this curve. So what we do is we subtract out the prediction for kappa equals 2, which is the loop erased random walk, which has the fractal dimension of 5/4. And we compare that, so it's a kind of a null subtraction. And in our simulations of loop erased random walk, you just get data that lays right along this line. So there's a particular analytic form for that. We subtract that off from the data. And the difference then between the measured probability distribution for our Ising spin glass and for the kappa equals 2 case is given by these sets of points for different size systems. Here, roughly, yeah, all these I'm showing you here are 128 by 1024. So they're 128 high and they're 1024 wide. We want a limit of large strips to really look at this because we don't want the domain wall to run around the cylinder and bump into itself. Okay, now. Yes? Did I do it wrong? 2.24, you're right. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. You're right. I knew that was odd. Okay. Well, this fractal dimension is only known to 1, to 0.01. So there's a factor of 8 in front of it. So, yeah. I find it hard to determine more precisely than 0.01. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought when you put the one parenthesis.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, you're right, absolutely right. So this looks like a better statistical control doing on a cylinder than by measuring the fractal dimension. I don't know why the statistical error seemed to be relatively lower in that case, but So it's 2.24, so 8 times 1.28 plus or minus 0.01 minus 1 gives you 2.28 plus or minus 0.08. That would be the prediction from the fractal dimension. Sorry, so let me write this over here too so people on this side of the room. So the fractal dimension would predict kappa equals 2.24 with an uncertainty of 8. I'm sorry, what did I say? No, it's 8 times df minus 1, and df minus 1 is 0.28. You multiply that by 8, you get 2.24, because Matt corrected by math. And
which central church does it correspond to?
Oh, gee. Nothing. That's a good question. So what central charge does it correspond to?
Central charge is equal to 1 minus 6 square root of kappa divided by
2. I haven't actually, honestly, surprisingly, I actually haven't plugged it in. It just doesn't look like anything that I know about, so from the usual thing. So I haven't actually, it's some number. Okay.
This is not, that should not be considered an indication of central shock, but it's ultimately if you consider the effect of central shock or the excitation, I guess. No?
I know less about that type of argument you're making about the central charge of the excitation. Conformal field theory is not. I mean, Andreas has something to you. I mean, you and Andreas would probably say similar things. I don't know what we should talk about that.
Kappa in a solido is the central charge corresponding.
Right.
No, no, we are looking at the statistics of the domain walls, and we think about this as SLE, and so we determine kappa.
Direct measures of?
No, there's nothing, the spin glass is not a conformal field theory, it's just the statistics of the domain walls.
Right.
That exhibit a statistic of SLE at a certain kappa. So the spin glass, it's the same expression as
So this is if I measure the probability distribution from the floating end or the free end. If I measure it from the localized end, and the closest I can get is with an effective kappa that's about 2.85, which is far off what you'd expect from the fractal dimension. So that's another reason. I mean, that if I didn't know anything about the energy scales, I would suggest, then it doesn't look like SLE if I measure it from the fixed endpoint. If I didn't know about this energy argument, I might be surprised. But again, I think it's an unnatural thing to do. But I mean, it's kind of an unnatural thing. So you can look at the angle distribution, it looks different. Now you can do the same thing with loop erase random walk, let me mention. So just to test the numerics, we did that. You do it for loop erase random walk, like I said, you get this if you use absorbing boundary conditions. If you use reflecting boundary conditions, you get a very different distribution. So the boundary conditions modifies the probability of passing to the left or right of the point for the loop erase random walk, and it does here in the spin glass as well. There's also a very nice prediction. Sorry? There's a very closely related thing where we can look at the distribution of the endpoint on the cylinder. So again, we just take a long strip, and what I was just telling you about was measuring how the domain wall passes through some circle. Or, it can do this also, but something about how it passes through a circle. And then it can also look at where it terminates. And there's a prediction for the distribution of the displacement of the terminus from the origin in this case, and we can measure that and compare with SLE predictions. And again, it lines up with kappa of about 2.32. And if I start from the localized end, I get a different effective kappa of about 2.85 once again. Okay, so I want to spend a few minutes talking a little bit about the I'm sorry, am I skipping over some questions or anything like this? Please interrupt me if I'm trying to. Okay, so let's look at this Markov property. So the Markov property is a measure of if you generate curves with an SLE, how they're independent of their previous history. And it's, let's talk about how to define that. I mean, one way to define it is to look at this quantity here. So let me tell you a little bit about this. So here, this black curve is the original domain wall in a spin glass. So comparing the periodic and anti-periodic conjugates, I generate the domain wall. And then, as is typical in analysis, like we heard about turbulence and so on earlier, is you start unfolding the conformal map that would have putatively generated this to reconstruct the Brownian process that could generate such a curve. So you take this curve and you generate it. Let me just give you, of course, you generate this function C of t which encodes the whole curve. And the question is that Brownian motion or not? And the map we use is the one appropriate for a strip geometry, the dipolar SLE, where the derivative of the conformal map is 2 over the tanh if you choose the height properly, pi over 2, and then identity at time t equals 0. And so we do a discrete version of that.
So do you do this from the edge, or do you do this from starting from the middle?
Right? Starting from the edge. Starting from the edge.
They always find that the boundary starts also interfering
with the analysis, isn't it? No, the SLE boundary, in SLE, the boundaries don't. I mean, I have free boundary conditions, so I believe I'm in this region where SLE looks like it has a chance of applying. And you could do the same thing with the loop race random walk. You, the conformal map is something that unfolds the curve.
I would choose something in the middle of the system and then do this analysis for the middle point.
I think Marcel is worrying that there's a system size that has to come in. In this analysis, the system size between the top and the bottom.
There is. If I did the standard SLE map on the half plane, but here there is. I mean, it's encoded. I mean, I guess I've factored it out. It's often written. There's a delta in the numerator and the delta in the denominator, where delta is the height of the system. But I've set delta, the height of the system, to be pi over 2, and so.
The question is, how do you map a cylinder?
Well, you don't. You map the cylinder onto itself, right? It's not. You can't do that. So you're mapping the annulus onto the annulus.
No, but that means that this is a strict, which is when you can decree, the equivalent to that.
No. So you could let me comment on that a little bit. We take strips as large as we can, so that the idea is the domain wall won't run into itself with high probability. The other thing is you can apply the standard half plane map near the origin, and for a good amount of time, it looks like it works well too. So it's telling you that the boundary at the other end isn't affecting the statistics down here until you get to later times. So you actually get pretty much the same results if you just assume this whole thing was on a half plane. Oh, okay. So there's an interesting question about, like, maybe let me rephrase this so I see if this addresses your concern, about if you have multiple paths, essentially, multiple nearly degenerate paths as you go to larger strips, and that's what would be fixing the endpoint. It'd be like selecting one of those, because as you go to larger system sizes in this direction, you get nearly degenerate domain walls. Is that?
My worry is that you have a boundary, and the boundary uses boundary scaling exponents and so on, and correction and scaling, because of the boundary that you imposed.
So which boundary did I impose?
The boundaries. It's this. No, I see the boundary scaling. And I would think that's what we only should work with respect to a dog issue.
You know a lot about this type of stuff that I don't know. I don't know.
The SLK by construction are emerged from the boundary. They are due to the boundary condition in the course.
So, but this is a process where if SLE applied, if dipolar SLE applied, which would be appropriate for the strip geometry like this, if dipolar SLE applied, this function that you would generate by evolving the curve would be a Brownian motion with a diffusion constant that would be given by kappa. So here's an example of the trace that's generated by it. Most of the information, most of the path is used up here, and you start to see discreteness effects at late times. The question is that a sample of Brownian motion or not? And you know, what are the statistical tests to determine whether this is truly Brownian motion or not? And one test is you could just measure the variance of that quantity, z, over samples. So I generate these curves for a bunch of samples, I sit at some fixed time, and I look at the variance. This is what people were talking about earlier with the, certainly in the turbulence case, and presumably some other talks that people have given. Yeah.
The statistics of the winding number.
Yes.
And statistics of the psi are the same. If it is a SLE, they are the same.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Right.
So if
right.
it is a SLE,
right.
it shows that it is SLE. Yeah. You don't need to check the second statistics.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
It will be checked.
That's right.
For both.
They right. That's right.
Yes.
Right. So this is, I view this as a check of our numerics, of lattice effects, of finite system effects in different ways. These are, yeah, mathematically, in some sense, some of these things are not totally independent of each other. I agree. And like you say, maybe even very dependent upon each other. If you're assuming SLE, but I'm trying to test SLE, so I'm looking for consistency between these different checks. Yes, absolutely, Gaussian.
And from this you can take a couple.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So if you look at the statistics of that over time, and you look at the variance, and here's one of these plots where here's time in this direction, here's the square, the variance divided by time, the expectation of c squared over time, and it's, you know, the first project I've done with SLE, and I was just amazed, you know, you put it in, and out comes these, this data, and the data is constant in time after some initial point, and the, and it's within this range again of about 2.16 to 2.32, maybe even a little closer to 2.32, but in that range, roughly with all, again, consistent within the fractal dimension and other checks of the kappa effective and with the fractal dimension. And this is, again, for the localized point, endpoint. So the localized is not agreeing, again, with the predictions, which is, again, consistent with.
Yeah. So you can take a kappa. Obtain the value of kappa from two sources, one from the winding number,
yes.
another one from psi.
Yes.
Both of those.
They're the same. That's what I'm saying here. They're the same within errors, yes. Okay, and is it Gaussian? Yes, I've looked at higher cumulants. Are there correlations that just looking at the variance or the higher cumulants in time that this is not that might be hidden in there. I have not seen any correlations. I don't know how to prove that something is actually a statistical sample of Brownian motion except for throwing, you know, doing correlation functions and stuff like this, which we've done. It all looks okay.
So what other correlations are you thinking about?
Oh, like you can look at the time-time correlations. You can look at the, I can look at this curve, which I've done. You have to be a little careful about it because the discreteness size changes as you go here. If you look at the distance between zero crossings, there's a little problem with that because it's a discrete process, but you can get some statistics for that. So you can look at whether it has a t to the minus 3 halves tail. Okay? I think that's a nice one because, and as I've actually suggested to be my cosmologist friend, I'm saying, how do I check this? I just look at the zero crossings. I go, hey, that's a great idea. Yes, I've done. Sorry.
It works.
And it works, yes. Over a limited range, again, because the discreteness size changes, so it's kind of hard to define exactly what zero crossings are in some cases. Okay. Now I'm going to go to the minimal spanning tree, which I've not really carefully defined. It's a curve that you can generate. It's a tree on a lattice which has minimum weight. You put down edges on a lattice, and you select the edges that will connect all the vertices on the graph, such that the total weight of those edges is minimized. It's an optimization type of problem. So some people seem to be thinking about what I actually said there. So let me draw a picture. So a minimal spanning tree, for those who don't, was you assign weights to each of these edges, and you find the tree, that is the loopless object that connects all the vertices that has minimal total weight. And that would be the minimal spanning tree. And there's a unique one if these are real valued variables. So you can look at the statistics of paths on there. Doesn't matter. They don't have to be positive in this case.
Also, but then you have to impose that it's a tree.
You have to impose it as a tree, that's all. I impose it as a tree. So I pick the minimum weight tree. Okay?
And how do I get a curve there?
You can pick, there are different ways to do it. One way to do it Is to pick just two points and see and look at the connection between them. If that, there's a unique path between two points. I could pick point at the boundary if I'm worried about boundary conditions and so on. Wilson has actually analyzed this problem in great detail and finds different values depending on how you do things. Yes?
It's a big advantage of real estate.
In there or in the spin glass? It looks Gaussian. The ground state energy has Gaussian fluctuations.
Gaussian.
Yes. Because the excitations have low energy in the large system size limit, so you dominate essentially by central limit theorem type things, because it goes into the realization of energy. Sorry? Yeah, it's Gaussian.
But the combination of Gaussian Gaussian for the power system.
Get rid of the volume for the ground state energy in the spin glass, right? So you can apply the same analysis to paths that are from the minimal spanning tree in some of the ways that we, like Falkovich was speaking about for turbulence, looking at the isolines and so on. You can do a similar type of analysis, and you find that the effect of kappa for the minimal spanning tree has a plateau in it. So it looks SLE-like, but it's not.
So, do you believe the fact that it goes down after some time?
That's a finite size effect. That's a finite size effect. These are finite size effects. Yeah. So I mean, if you look at this previous curve that I had for the spin glass, you see that there are drop offs here due to finite size effects. Okay. Because the time becomes limited. I'm not scaling time. I'm scaling time maybe differently than other people do. This is not system size. I mean, the time grows larger as the system size grows larger. Okay, but the point here is that there's a plateau, a very big plateau over well over a decade for the minimal spanning tree, and it's not SLE. So
can you see evidence of deviations from Gaussianness of this?
I need to look at that more. I have the statistics. I haven't done all that analysis yet. So that's a good question. Does it look Gaussian or not? If my memory serves me right, let me just say, if I remember right, it looks very Gaussian also.
It looks Gaussian,
but I could do a more detailed check. Actually, I've measured the correlations. The correlations look short range just as for the spin glass. I get the same correlation functions essentially here as I do for the CFT and the spin glass. So it's telling us there's something more subtle in the CFT that's breaking the conformal variance in the minimal spanning tree. So the cautionary thing here, that it's not... Now, the value of this kappa is a little different than what would be expected from the fractal dimension. But there's a plateau. Okay.
Can you remind us what the evidence is that Wilson had that it's not conformal invariant?
He tried a couple of different things. He actually took the minimal spanning trees and applied conformal maps on them and rotated them on the disk and looked at the distribution of various points. And another thing is he actually just measured various perimeters and so on and measured the effective kappas for different things and found that the relations that you'd expect are violated.
But it doesn't mean that in spanning tree there is no conformal invariant objects. Simply, this object which is...
That's a very good point.
Good objects.
That may be a very good
there
point.
There are good objects which are currently conformal invariant. It's spanning tree, but it's C to minus 2.
No, for that's uniform spanning tree. The uniform spanning tree is absolutely conformally invariant in SLE and everything.
Excuse me, I just noticed that this 2.3 is suspiciously close to 2.6 gradient upward, which is percolation. 2.6 is 16 divided by 6. Is this error bar, I have to take seriously this error bar, right? 16 divided by 6.
Eight-thirds. Eight-thirds. The boundary of the percolation is eight-thirds, right?
Yeah.
2.67.
Okay, yeah.
I would take this. I point 0.2, 0.3, 0.4 if you push me, right? I try to be careful about error bars. 0.3 is no way, no way. Absolutely not. I generally don't swear on those. I'll swear on, Halliday and Resnick or whatever it's on. So...
Because, percolation looks like exploit of all possible numerical errors. So whatever, if you do some error, you just see percolation.
Okay, I want to wrap. Can I have a few more minutes? Just like 5 or 10 minutes? Okay. because I really want to discuss this here, which is some stuff. And actually, I was talking to Matt Hastings the other day, and I think, I'm not sure if I quoted you exactly properly, but you said something like, must fail microscopically, right? It does, it must. But I mean, you said it to me the other day, but I mean, we knew that, but it's just saying that it's I just wanted to make sure that you got, you know, that you all knew that this happened also. So if you look at this, so what is this? Again, for people, to remind people, what vanishes? Oh, that vanishes. Okay, yes, that's on a short, fairly short fuse. Okay. So the story is, you look at paths gamma in your system. In this case, I'm going to draw them with the top and bottom since I'm working on a cylinder. And you look at, you pick some gamma 1, and you say, well, if the curve starts with gamma 1, what is the probability that it will finish with gamma 2? So here's the probability of starting with, if you start with gamma 1, what is the probability that you will finish with gamma 2 if your process, your method of generating curves works on some domain D here, which I've shown as a half strip? The question is that equal or not to the probability of taking the domain D, cutting out some curve gamma 1, and asking if the domain wall or the object or whatever you are looking at starts at some point C, which is at the end of gamma 1, if it starts there, what is the probability distribution for gamma 2? So this is just a general thing you might look about measures of curves on different sets. So is the probability of a curve ending with gamma 2, given that it starts with gamma 1 on a particular domain, the same as the probability that that on this cut domain, the one we've cut out this particular path, that you select those paths that you generate somehow, if you select those that start at C, does that have the same distribution? That's the statement of the Markov property. It looks complicated. It's natural within statistical mechanical models. It's natural within percolation. It turns out that this is what drives the SLE thing. It's just these probabilities can be written in this fashion, this relationship, and so then you can conclude that you have Brownian motion once you have this relationship in conformal invariance for the Loebner evolution. Okay? So, as I said, like Matt was saying the other day, this must fail microscopically. You can construct things where you can see how that happens. That means in small systems it cannot hold in the spin glass. So why does this look like SLE? So we've tried to directly look at this in moderate size systems. Moderate means 6, 8, 12 squared type of systems. I'll show you some data for that. So what we do is here it's shown for a 6x6 system. For example, we take 40 million samples. We're generating more data on that right now, but this seems to be good enough statistics to do quite a bit. You can pick a gamma 1, and then you say, well, I look at all curves, all domain walls that start with gamma 1, and then I look at the probability distribution for gamma 2. Or I then take this lattice and I go in with my scissors and I cut out these bonds, and then I generate all the domain walls, and then I focus on those that start at C. Some won't start at C, some will start over here. I select those that start at C, and I calculate the probability for each of those. And I'm going to compare those probability distributions, of course. So here's an example for, like, this is an earlier set of data. This was like 4 million samples or something like that. So this is gamma 2. So here, gamma 1, well, this should be V. Gamma 1 is just like what I drew for you.
What's the notation?
I'll tell you. Okay. So this is vertical. Actually, this one goes vertical. I changed the slide. This goes vertical, left, vertical, left. Okay, and then it goes vertical, right, 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 vertical, so on. Okay. Actually, I'm using a slightly... Anyway, so then I can sort the gamma 2s and look at how many of them happen in each case. So here is for the case where I've cut out a domain. I've made a table here of gamma 2s that I see. the number of times I see each gamma 2. Okay. And then I normalize that probability distribution. Okay. And then I'm going to compare it with, so essentially I have a short notation. So I'm going to fix gamma 1. Gamma 1 is going to be this particular path that I'm going to show you. For this example, I've checked other paths, of course. I pick a particular gamma 1, I look at gamma 2, I calculate probability distribution, I'm going to do it for P prime. And somehow I think the plot ended up on the next page. So this is for the spin glass. These are the shorter paths down here. They have higher probability. And P, that is in the uncut domain of terminating with gamma 2, given that you start with gamma 1, are these curves with statistical error bars. And then the red ones are for the P prime. And they pretty much line up with each other within statistical errors. But it's on a moderate size system. I'm showing you a 6x6 system. For a 4x4 system, they don't line up exactly. There's a bigger gap here and a little bit of a gap here. As I go to larger systems, I'm getting more and more agreement in the probability distribution. The jump comes from the fact that these paths are all of length, the shortest possible ones that will reach you to the top. And though they are in some sense unlikely in a large system, in the smaller systems they have higher weight. And then there are more longer paths where you double back. And so there's a jump here from paths of length, I don't know what, I can't remember exactly, it's from length 8 to length 10 or something like that for gamma 2. Okay. So they, later on this gets smoothed out. I sorted them lexicographically. I took my encoding and I sorted them lexicographically. So there's no particular order to these, except that sorting them lexicographically does tend to put the ones with higher probability at the front of the list. Then here's further out. So this is for paths gamma 2 in this lexicographical ordering that are from 1 to, I believe it's 1, 200, it might be in this case. It's either 100 or 200, I should be able to tell, but it's one of the two. And then here's for paths 1200 through 1300. And now the probabilities here are getting much smaller, so I have larger statistical errors. But generally, they agree within statistical errors. I mean, they do agree within statistical errors. I mean, sometimes they don't overlap within error bars, but you expect that.
Could you try to do things like that for the minimal spanning tree? Do you have any insight as to what you would get?
Next slide. Okay. So here's the loop race random walk, which is equivalent to the minimal spanning tree. No, I have not.
That is not
done there yet. Yeah, I'm working on that. Okay, but I will show you what I've got already for the loop erase random walk. Okay, so the minimal spanning tree I have not done. Okay. Yet. So loop erase random walk, I'm showing you here with absorbing boundary conditions, which is where we believe SLE applies. So loop erase random walk with absorbing boundary conditions mean I do a random walk, I cut out the loops. If I run back into the starting boundary, I throw away that path and I start a new one. I only keep those that never hit the bottom boundary. That's absorbing boundary conditions. And I plot P and P prime, and they agree very well with each other. So in this case, loop erase random walk is something we understand very well. It's very simple. It's a sheep. Okay. But now if I put on reflecting boundary conditions, same thing, L equals 6, you see it distinct. You see that they don't line up with each other. And so that, you know, shows that it's not SLE-like because you don't have the Markov property in this case. So here I'm showing three sets of data. I'm showing for the two-dimensional spin glass where it lines up. It looks good. It doesn't look so good for this case, which we know it should fail on. I've not done the minimal spanning tree yet. Give me a few days. Where we do believe it should work, it works also. So that gives us some test of this tool in measuring what's going on. Use moderate size systems. Yeah.
I forgot what you did here in the last case where there's no alignment. What happened?
Here there's reflecting boundary conditions where the random walk doesn't get absorbed when it hits here, but it bounces back. Okay, there you get the same fractal dimension once again as you do in the absorbing boundary condition case. Okay, I'm sorry, I've run over quite a bit. Let me just summarize here. So we find a kappa of effective You know, the error bars are, you can choose which ones you like to look at. I think this is a fairly good estimate of where something that lines up with all our data, something about this value. And it's consistent with the fractal dimension. We find that if you look at larger systems, at least the Markov property holds, it breaks down in smaller size systems. Boundary conditions are very important in deciding what you're looking at. Again, we've looked at, you know, done the same analysis path for several different systems to try to check that. Okay. I think that's, yeah, all I wanted to say pretty much.
Any more questions?
Yeah, well, I just want to, so the message I got, so maybe we need some tools to where we tell us how good these, you know, these probes are. So I think it looks to me like it's absolutely crucial to understand how these tests behave if you consider a case which is not SLE, like the minimalist manager. It's probably, well, maybe listening to your talk, that's probably a key thing that should be done, right?
I mean, I think that's the thing we're trying to do, is that's what we started to do, and more work can certainly be done on that, is really seeing the discriminatory power of these tests to see what, yeah.
Is there another example that is not conformal invariant where you don't have SLE?
Something about boundary condition, you have to think of the map of properties is correct. If you look at perfect boundary condition,
okay,
map of properties.
Right.
So it's not useful.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Right. So that's something where we really know what's going on. And we can use that to discriminate the test, right. Okay.